they'd go to the phone and they'd call the sergeant or whoever they call and say, boss, we don't know what to do with these guys, squatters. They seem to be, I don't know, they have mail, they got Con Ed bill, and I don't know what to do. They wouldn't know what to do, essentially, because, again, when you come outside of the realm of the experience of the enemy, so to speak, they're confused. They don't really know how to respond to you. They've adapted over time, but, again, in general, it's when you come outside the realm of their experience, they don't quite know how to respond to you, and that's what happened. So, basically, until the point that the political nature of what we were doing kind of hit home to the powers that be down at City Hall, when it was clear to them that they needed to nip the thing in the bud, then they would, from the top down, instruct the local police to go about and try to push us out, or they'd come, you know, they realized early on, because we would defend ourselves, all the buildings had barricades, and we would have means of securing the building so that it wasn't going to be easy. We made it very difficult, and through letting the people know in the community and media releases to the press and so forth, you know, just basically showing people that unless people stood up, there wasn't going to be any housing for people, there wasn't going to be the ability for people to meet their basic needs. So we were trying to provide an example in some ways, but mostly we were organizing to defend ourselves. And, you know, it was effective to a large extent that we were able to maintain the buildings throughout a period of pretty intense repression from 85 to 90. You know, we had a bunch of run-ins with the police as functionaries for the real estate industry or the various mayors' political agendas or what have you.
Who owns the buildings that you squat in?
Who owns the buildings? Basically, when the abandonment took place, this whole planned shrinkage, when we created all this abandoned housing, which I was alluding to earlier, because the process of squatting emerges out of a situation where there's massive displacement, homelessness, and so forth. So that's the context within it takes place.
But, I mean, who were the original owners of the buildings then moved into?
Yeah, the thing is that these buildings, take the Lower East Side here, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s, a lot of these buildings were owned by what we might refer to as small owners, like, you know, ma and pa owners. They'd have a building or whatever. Sometimes after the late 60s, where I was making the point before, there were a whole series of things that took place which made it very difficult for small owners to maintain their buildings. Suddenly, there were new taxes put on them. There were various courts set up. In New York City, there was a court set up to bring in these small owners and take their buildings away from them for the inability to pay taxes. Or in some cases where, you know, the owners just threw their arms up because the neighborhoods were burning down around them and they just had to get rid of them or what have you. All I'm saying is that the mechanisms for the transfer of massive numbers of units from diversified small owners into the hands of one public entity took place from, you know, the early 70s right through the sort of middle and later 70s. And an agency was set up in New York here called Housing Preservation and Development, which is a misnomer. But that agency was set up to basically take in all of these properties that were transferred from small owners into what essentially was a public agency that was going to broker these buildings to the rich over time and land bank them. So these abandoned buildings that were all cinder blocked up were ostensibly owned by the city, right, by the so-called public entity, the Housing Preservation and Development, which along with the housing authority and the public housing, the projects, was the biggest landlord in New York. They had, you know, 100,000 units when we started taking buildings here on the Lower East Side. They owned those buildings ostensibly through this process, which we always maintained was illegitimate and illegal. But essentially, that's how the city became the quote-unquote owner. Now, what they did with these buildings is just warehouse them. They didn't invest a whole lot of money in upgrading them. They just put cinder blocks on them, very often did not put any kind of tarps on the roofs or anything like that. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of apartments here, just block after block after block in different neighborhoods and down here. And the buildings were just sitting there, open to the elements, just sort of rotting away, some for 10, 15, 20 years. All right, so this Housing Preservation and Development is a misnomer. It was about land banking, keeping those buildings off the market, inflating the whole rental thing, and then later on brokering those buildings to the incoming kind of the yuppie forces and various capital reinvestments and so forth after this whole period of massive disinvestment, redlining on the part of banks, where they wouldn't give those small owners secondary mortgages on their buildings. So it all contributed to this process where there was this massive abandonment and destruction of whole neighborhoods, not to mention arson for profit and, you know, the whole burning down of whole large sections. I mean, there were nights in the Bronx so I could stand on my roof and the sky would be red in some areas. There was a process which I feel was part of a social control mechanism. This wasn't simply the invisible hand of capitalism in the housing market, that there were strategies that were hatched as early as the Kerner Commission report in 68, which dealt with civil disorder in their chapter 17 of the Kerner Commission report, which dealt with housing. All right, now this is a civil disorder commission dealing with civil disorder, namely riots, so-called riots in the cities, and they have chapter 17 deals with housing. And in there, they advocate a process of dispersal of the urban poor, forcing them out of the cities. What later was recognized to be this program known as spatial deconcentration. The concept and the mechanisms of this program was put forth by Yolanda Ward and the people from the Grassroots Unity Conference, Yolanda Ward being a black 22-year-old Howard University student who, along with some others, expropriated these documents from HUD, which referred to spatial deconcentration and the whole notion of displacing large numbers of poor people from the urban centers for fear that they pose a threat to the stability of America. At this point, 1967, don't forget, there were so-called riots in 109 cities in 1967 alone. So that the housing question, as it related to the issue of social control, became an operative aspect of the politics and the strategy of squatting both in the Bronx and on the Lower East Side here. We saw squatting as an antidote in some respects, not only to the short-term housing needs, but this whole process of spatial deconcentration that people had to defend themselves on the street in actual concrete ways to create communities of resistance, to resist not only the displacement, because if you think of it metaphorically, if a big fist comes down in a neighborhood and smashes a densely populated poor community in, let's say, Harlem, and all those people go shooting out of this dense fist, you know, if you see it visually, and they're shooting out all over the place, well, those people have to be, where are they going to go, right? Well, what we saw is that the process of spatial deconcentration, of planned shrinkage, of creating massive hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of homeless people and displaced people around the country, was the parallel strategy that went along with that was the creation of the shelter system around the country. The shelter system emerged in, again, in the late 70s, early 80s, during this period following massive destruction of neighborhoods all throughout the late 60s and through the 70s. The federal shelter system was set up to, in a sense, reconcentrate all those people who had been pushed out of the urban centers, or at least a good portion of them, who are now known as, quote-unquote, homeless people. They were never referred to as displaced former tenants. They were now this new breed of person called homeless person, which by now is there's a genocidal aspect when people are forced to live on the street or in shelters and so forth. The life expectancy rate in the shelter system is much lower than it is for the so-called normal population. The incidence of AIDS and TBs in the shelter is double what it is outside of the shelters. That it becomes really clear that, you know, the whole process of social control, spatial deconcentration, forcing people out of the inner cities and creating this homeless population as a form of state repression is also an element of genocide. When you're thinking in terms of the seriously ill effects that people who are faced with this situation, you know, how they're living. So our strategy in terms of squatting had to do with survival, particularly in poor communities, had to do with, you know, empowerment to the degree that we're able to defend the buildings and so forth. And only secondarily, but still important, has to do with deconstructing the ideology, the sanctification of private property, that somehow the right to make a profit on a building, to speculate on buildings, this whole real estate gambit, you know, where people, this building was built, you know, that you're living in, you know, 60 years ago, and it's been paid for 15 times already, but this whole speculative process as it affects the housing market, that the whole thing was a sham, that squatting effectively could concretely and practically halt the process of speculation where it was occurring. In other words, in our buildings, there's been no speculation. The Lower East Side is completely gentrified, or at least in large segments of it are. And yet, that speculation passed over us. We were able to, you know, maintain our buildings as affordable and so forth. And this is what we're saying, is that the only way we're going to be able to really maintain our right concretely to a home that's affordable to people who fall within the kind of lower income working class category at this point in time is to seize it and to organize effectively to defend it.
So you are saying that spatial deconcentration was consciously planned, carried out, and it's actually referred to in this 1968 Kerner Commission report?
Yeah, if you go to the Kerner Commission report, which again was officially titled the National Commission on Civil Disorder, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. Again, it was set up in 68, and half of its participants were military and police people. According to the executive order which set it up under President Johnson, they were set up not only to study the causes of riots, so-called riots, and to deal with short-term solutions to riots, and that's where the Army Task Force, part of the Kerner Commission, came in terms of the use of non-lethal weapons and the setting up of Operation Garden Plot, which deals with civil disturbance planning and so forth. But Chapter 17 of that report deals specifically with the issue of housing and was authored by Anthony Downs. Anthony Downs, who has a long counterinsurgency history dealing with social control elements, police elements within poor communities. He authored that chapter and in there advocates a dispersal strategy for the urban centers. You know, this whole notion of, in a book that he wrote called Opening Up the Suburbs, which he advocated not only pushing people out of these poor communities as though the suburbs were going to be welcoming them with open arms. In any case, if you look at that chapter, then you get a sense of the direction that these counterinsurgency strategies, essentially, were looking to implement vis-a-vis housing. Most people have a difficult time bridging the question of housing and the whole notion of social control, particularly as it deals with kind of militaristic-sounding kinds of approaches. But if you looked at areas like the South Bronx and then realized, you know, these bombed-out areas and so forth, and realized that this was happening nationally across the country, to suggest that this was just some kind of invisible process that was not part of some sort of conscious strategy, particularly if you read Chapter 17 in the Kerner Report, is foolhardy. So, I mean, our analysis basically led us to position that squatting was a defensive tactic, on the one hand, to defend against this forced removal and to hold land and also to deconstruct, you know, ideologically the reverence for capitalism and private property, but at the same time to create communities of resistance, areas where people could organize in other areas as well. The reason being that these urban centers were under attack was because they were, in the late 60s, organizing effectively. The numbers of various liberation movements, as Black Panthers, the Young Lords, and various other peace, justice, liberation movements in the urban centers. Well, this was a threat, and the way to eliminate that threat in part, or as the Kerner Commission, Johnson's executive order, mandated, long-term solutions to riots. Well, long-term solutions to a riot in Harlem might be to displace a third of the population, which is essentially what they did.
I'm speaking with writer, researcher, and urban squatter Frank Morales. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, Frank, you say that the spatial deconcentration strategy led to the creation of a shelter system. Is this shelter system a national system?
Yeah, the spatial deconcentration, the pushing people out, forcing people out of communities led to the shelter system. If you look at the creation of the shelter system nationally, particularly under FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency chairs a board which oversees the shelter system across the country. They saw homelessness as an emergency management situation. So the shelter system was set up as separate and distinct from any kind of approach to dealing with housing. For instance, in New York here, these large-scale barracks were created where, you know, you'd have like a gymnasium full of cots, and you'd have people just sleeping on these cots in these barracks, right? That form of sheltering people, who mostly happen to be poor, Black and Latino people, that approach would have been illegal prior to 1979 or, you know, in the early 80s. Basically, what occurred was that there were suits that were made, legal approaches, by, for instance, groups like the National Coalition for the Homeless in 79 and 80 in Washington, D.C., which is the same time FEMA is actually set up in Washington, D.C. in 79 and 80. But in any case, the suit that took place sued the city administration here in New York around the right to shelter. when in fact the New York State Constitution guarantees a right to a home. Now, the suit was not around a right to a home, right? So the state was not forced to create housing for homeless people or people who were underhoused. The suit was around a right to shelter. And what that did was to create the legislative infrastructure for the shelter system, which heretofore had been illegal, inhumane. In other words, you couldn't put people who were homeless in a barracks before the Coalition for the Homeless sued for the right to shelter as separate and distinct from the right to a home. So in any case, the National Coalition for the Homeless, emerging at this point, along with FEMA, which oversees the national board, which oversees the shelter system nationally, you know, add to that the actual day-to-day life within these barracks places. I refer to it as low-intensity detention center. Anyone who's been to them would recognize that. I mean, these are places that, you know, there's video surveillance apparatuses, you know, everywhere you look. They're like prisons. The guys are, and women are told they can, they have to leave at 7 or 8 or 9 in the morning, and they can come back in only as late as so-and-so, and their lives are strictly regimented. That, as I said before, the life expectancy of people who are in these shelters, as well as people who are living on the streets, and who knows how many people are won't go into these shelters. There have been studies. There was a study done by some medical people here in New York about this whole question of the shelter system. In any case, the approach has been towards controlling, detaining, isolating, disempowering people who, you know, were displaced in this area, and FEMA and the shelter system sort of came into being as part of that strategy.
I don't think that most people know that shelters used to be illegal. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been possible for the city of New York to, quote-unquote, house people or shelter people in a barrack-style approach. There are various what are called warrant of habitability laws. They wouldn't have met the standards that are required to make it a legal housing situation. So that the right to shelter suit forced the city's hand, quote-unquote, to put people in barracks where they could be more closely monitored, where the incidence of AIDS and TB would be much higher than it was on the street, and so on. That's just the objective circumstances of it. I mean, I tend to think that that was part of the strategy, to avoid people organizing around the right to a home rather than a right to shelter, which confuses people, but they're quite different.
Could you talk a little bit more about how spatial deconcentration was accomplished? It sounded like there were small businesses who could not continue and had to either sell out or go bankrupt. Was this an attack on the middle and lower middle class in the city centers after the riots of the 60s?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was very clear in the late 60s and 70s that a lot of the small owners were not able to maintain their buildings. And there were various things that took place. The most telling was the whole process of redlining on the part of banks. So, for instance, somebody who had a building here on 10th Street and Avenue B since the 20s had been getting their mortgages refinanced or what have you by the local bank and had the relationship with the bank and so forth all those years. Suddenly, the bank was not willing to refinance their loan. And people who own buildings were not necessarily making money on rents. They were making any kind of profit that they could put back into the building if they were honorable from the refinancing that the bank would give them on their mortgage based on the upwardly spiraling value of their building, et cetera, et cetera. In any case, when the banks decided that they would no longer make loans or refinance mortgages in particular neighborhoods, right, and the concept redlining refers to, you know, a map inside of a bank president's office or something where they have a red line drawn around the neighborhood and they say, well, we're not giving any loans to that neighborhood. So the reality of it was that there was massive disinvestment on the part of certain banks targeting certain neighborhoods. They wouldn't make loans in those neighborhoods, even if they were situated in those neighborhoods. When I was living in the South Bronx in 1980, we went to a Citibank on the corner of 149th Street and 3rd Avenue, right in the center of the South Bronx, and we went into their bank, and through the Community Reinvestment Act, you're able, a public citizen is able to go into a bank and demand to see their community reinvestment portfolio, which basically lists the loans that they've made in that neighborhood. Okay? I think you can still do this. And they literally have to supply you with a little table and light and all that, and you can look through this. In any case, the bank on 149th Street and 3rd Avenue in the South Bronx that year, I made, I think it was like 150 loans, like that. 149 of those loans were made to Westchester County people, which is, if you're familiar with New York, it's like the South Bank's very poor, and then the Westchester is very wealthy. So this bank was obviously utilizing the funds that were coming into it from the small savings that people had in that community. It's just a poor neighborhood. And utilizing those funds, but not giving anything back. If a person came in for a loan or some small business or some person who had a building who was looking to get their roof fixed and needed a loan, they couldn't get those. There was disinvestment. You couple this with other kinds of effects. Sanitation pickup suddenly decreased. They were picking up garbage three times a week. Then they only picked it up one time a week. There was all kinds of drugs that were coming into these neighborhoods at this point. Down here on the Lower East Side, you could stand, you know, in any of the four corners down here, and it was like a market. And people would be limos lined up, and people would be just scoring left and right. And everybody knows now that there was, you know, in some cases, some, like, collusion between the local so-called law enforcement and the drug pushers. So, I mean, you had this whole process. You have all these, what is referred to as a synergy of effects in these communities, which led to the destruction of these neighborhoods, the physical destruction. So, you know, when you're dealing on that level, there are certain military analogies that are not so far off, particularly when you're looking at a phrase like spatial deconcentration, which is a HUD term. It's used in some HUD documents. Others refer to planned shrinkage, or Downs in the Kerner Commission talks about dispersal, dispersing these urban populations and so forth. The process led to the complete destruction of certain communities, the disenfranchising of large numbers of people because you can't vote if you're sort of on the move, you're a migrant, you don't have any address. And eventually, you know, the sort of reconcentration, if not worse, the reconcentration of people within these barrack-style so-called shelter system, which is a low-intensity detention center.
And the destruction of these neighborhoods, it sounds quite clearly, was done purposefully. This was a conscious plan. I think that's what's so shocking.
If you look at the period in 1967, 68, 69, in there was great fear among the corporate elite and their henchmen at the Pentagon and in the Congress that insurrection was breaking out. You know, maybe hard to recall what this was like, but they were very concerned that the ship of state was on rocky terrain. By 1975, the Trilateral Commission, David Rockefeller's European, Japanese, American think tank, issued the Crisis in Democracy Report, you know, authored by Samuel Huntington, NYU Press, 1975, which concludes with a statement that, therefore, there are potentially desirable limits to the indefinite extension of political democracy. That there are limits to the indefinite extension of political democracy. I mean, this is the sense that they had at that point was that there was what Huntington referred to in that report, Trilateral Report, as an excess of democracy. There was too much democracy. Therefore, that was the reason for this massive protest, the anti-war movement, et cetera, et cetera. Their analysis of the 60s had to do all with too much democracy, we have to shrink democracy. So the shrinking of democracy, the analogy is planned shrinkage on the housing front, is to undercut the ability of people to organize if you take out their house. The same Trilateral Report referred to the ominous equation from their perspective of education and political participation. Huntington at one point argues in the book that, well, there seem to be studies that black political participation is equated to black people going more to college. So by shrinking one, we might shrink the other. I mean, this is the kind of analysis these people made. The book is basically a blueprint for counter-revolution. And what you're seeing in terms of the attack on the ability of poor working-class people to move into higher education and so forth grows right out of this period. It's a counter-revolutionary strategies that deal in the issue of social control in terms of communities on the housing question, on questions of health care, the availability of work, jobs, etc. It's all part of, from my perspective, it's all part of a counterinsurgency that grew out of this period and is still with us. I think these same notions are still operative in some senses. It's more pronounced now. But, I mean, it's hard for people to recognize that the kinds of things that took place in community after community after community around this country in terms of the displacement of massive numbers of people and the emergence of homeless population as being anything other than some invisible consequence of economy alone. You know, from the left point of view, well, capitalism doesn't want to supply housing for poor people, and that's why there's so many poor people and so forth and so on. Well, I think that if GM, from its board headquarters can sit there and define the color of its left bumper from its boardroom right down to the shop floor, that's not a conspiracy. The elite is capable of organizing in its own self-interest and seeing that, particularly if you read reports coming out of the Kerner Report, which advocate these dispersal programs, it seems to me it's more likely that this is part of a conscious effort. At this point, we've seen the effect of it, the complete destruction of whole communities, the warehousing of people in shelter system, and at this point, given the kind of evolutionary, kind of deleterious effects on people's health over a sustained period in terms of being homeless and so forth, that there's a genocidal aspect to it as well. So, I mean, I think that people really need to look very closely about what we're dealing with in terms of homelessness and so forth. It's an issue of state repression. It's not the invisible hand of economy or, you know, the sort of moral problem with the poor or God's wrath upon poor people or any number of kind of superstitions. This is a conscious strategy to keep people off balance. And, you know, if it was about providing, but it was not about that, it's much more expensive, for instance, to maintain the shelter system than it is to provide the housing. In New York here, we have these so-called welfare hotels and so forth. It's everyday knowledge that there's massive amounts of fraud and money and all kinds of waste in these places. It's like what we hear about the prisons. It costs $150,000 a year to keep one inmate in a jail when we could build them a house, send them to school, and so forth and so on. That's the point. It's not about that. It's about social control. It's about genocide. It's about disempowerment. So this is counterinsurgency within the context of housing. We need to break down the separations that we have in terms of these categories and begin to see some of these questions in a new way.
Frank, could you tell us again the name of the book you referred to? I think people would be interested in that.
Yeah, I think it's something that everyone should have in their library. It's called Crisis in Democracy. It's NYU Press. It's out of print, but these days maybe people know, can find these things. NYU Press, 1975. It's very worthwhile reading. You hear a lot about the Trilateral Commission from some of the more esoteric, sects, but it's real. I mean, there's this report, and it's interesting to me that it was authored by Samuel Huntington, who currently is pushing this whole clash of civilizations, and, you know, he's one of these people they constantly sort of recirculate, you know. He's kind of one of the intellectual, although it's an oxymoron, I mean, in terms of his politics and moral viewpoint. But in any case, it's The Crisis in Democracy, the final report of the Trilateral Commission, and it's, I think the subtitle is On the Governability of Society or something like that. It's basically dealing with the question of how to maintain the ship of state amidst the quote-unquote distemper, which is another word for protest of the period. And again, this is in 1975, so they're looking back, analyzing, making recommendations in terms of reducing the educational availability for blacks. It talks about the media as being a problem during Vietnam. You see where that's wound up. So it kind of lays out strategies. That and the Kerner Commission report, which I'd also recommend, particularly Chapter 17, if people are interested in the housing question as it relates to civil disorder. Again, we have to break down separation between these categories and begin to see exactly what's going on. So I would recommend both of those. And the Kerner Commission report, you know, you really want to get the original, the New York Times version, kind of like the Warren Commission version. That's okay, but it's less accurate. So you need the government printing office version of the Kerner Commission report, particularly Chapter 17.
I'm speaking with writer, researcher, and urban squatter Frank Morales. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Frank, I wanted to finish up with your personal experience in New York City. You mentioned that there are 11 buildings now that are occupied and perhaps owned by a nonprofit, but that in the process over the past few decades, several buildings were lost to arson.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about what happened now? Were some of the buildings attacked by the city?
Well, I wouldn't say they were attacked by the city. They were basically people who either are working in the interests of real estate people who saw us as a problem. Because don't forget, if people on a block recognize that, hey, some people took over those buildings and they're still there and so on, you create a model. You know, you inspire people to begin to move outside of the real estate game. And that once you begin to create an environment in a neighborhood that is not friendly to speculation. See, I mean, real estate people come into a neighborhood, they look, and if there's three or four squats on that block, they may not want to invest in that block, and it creates like a geometric effect. So it's very dangerous from the point of view of these real estate people.
You had mentioned Mayor Giuliani, and that when he was mayor there in New York City, that several of the buildings were attacked. Maybe I misunderstood you.
Well, we were, in a couple of cases. In 1989, we had a building on 8th Street here that suffered an arson. And when I said it was, you know, you could smell the gasoline, the fire department came, and it was determined that it was an arson, and so on and so forth. And we commenced to try to defend the building, and we had major showdown with the police on that. Just to give people a sense of what went down there, the night when it was finally determined that they were going to demolish the building, they surrounded not only the building with riot cops and so forth, but for 4 or 5 square blocks in the neighborhood, there was a cop posted every 10 feet. Just a complete neighborhood, and in order to get home, you had to show ID. It was a sort of a martial law situation. In another case, we had a tank roll down 13th Street, an armored personnel carrier, along with SWAT teams and automatic rifles and helicopters. Basically, an all-out kind of military assault. The FEMA truck would be there coordinating communications and so on. I mean, these were, from our perspective, kind of police state, military-style operations. So we had a number of confrontations. And at that time, hundreds of people would come out from the neighborhood. We would get involved in, kind of pushing and shoving with the police to defend the house. And some of those times were rough in the sense that, you know, we were not always able to withstand the kind of police repression that came down. We lost some buildings that way and had to watch them be demolished. But at the same time, we won the war in a sense because it would create so much negative publicity. And would also give the city a sense that, hey, every time we make a move and try to take one of these buildings, it sets us back so much that they were unable, after a period of time, to just continually come at us because we kept the resistance up.
Frank, is there anything else that you would like to add that people need to know about this subject?
I just think that the important thing for people to know is that it's possible for people to work together. You know, people would say to us, well, you don't have the ability to renovate those buildings. You're not going to get people to work together who don't know each other. You know, there's all this kind of stuff. And that's the thing, is that if people have the audacity and the ability, the vision, to make this move, to look at the building, do some research, get in there and start working on it, then people will realize how much power they have. And, you know, there's no way of knowing that unless you take action. It's like we're saying, there's no human right to a home unless it's in some abstract realm somewhere. You make it real. And once you make it real and people feel it, and I can't begin to explain to you what it feels like to function within a context of, and not to sound, you know, whatever, but it's freedom to get outside of the claws of this whole speculation and housing market, this whole profit-making off of the land. You know, the land can't be bought and sold. People's right to a home is literally that. But, you know, that whole thing which everybody lives with, if people could just taste what it's like to live free of that and to understand that it's not just to pay, you know, a 50% or 75% or whatever, like a lot of poor working class people are paying these rents and so forth. The whole thing is a fraud. And if we organize to take buildings and to take land and create housing as a human right and do it collectively, there's no amount of police that can stop it once it's really gotten going. This is a phenomenon that's taking place around the world. I mean, the idea of people seizing the resources to create housing for themselves is the dominant movement in the world. And I'm not some extreme statement. There are more people moving from the rural areas to the urban centers over the last 10, 15 years than any other mass movement of people in history. The largest migration of human beings ever in the history of the planet is taking place currently, and it's a move from rural to urban. That's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of militarism, agriculture being bought up by the big corporate, et cetera, et cetera. People are coming into the cities. There's this large move. No urban center around the world is equipped to deal with housing people, particularly poor people, whether it's Nairobi, whether it's Lima, whether it's New York City. So things are no different here than they are in other places in terms of the ability or the willingness of the municipality to supply housing for poor and working class people that they can afford. So that's what's happening all over the planet. And what's happening as a result of that is that squatting is the predominant way that 75% of poor people around the world are currently housing themselves. 3/4 of the housing that poor people are living in around the world, 3/4, this is according to the United Nations Office on Human Settlements, 3/4 of the housing that they're currently living in, they made themselves. I mean, to me, that's a phenomenal statement both in a positive and negative way, but the fact is that most people, poor people who are living in a house, it's a house they created. They made themselves. They've seized their squatting. They're moving to seize their right to survive. But it's also a right to life as opposed to mere survival under some exploitive rental situation. Because that's the thing that I was referring to before, is that in terms of moving in this way, that you understand what it is to live and not to just survive as sort of a slave to some, you know, greedy landlord. And I think that the more people and tenants as well realize this and begin to organize rent strikes in order to finance squats and begin to collaborate, because these are processes that create a negative environment for real estate speculation. It's a campaign of dissuasion, of getting real estate interests and not interested in your community. You start seizing land, and right away, they're not going to want to be there. This is something that I've always wanted to communicate to people about the possibilities that exist in terms of squatting, you know, kind of direct action for housing.
And Frank, as a squatter, I assume you don't pay rent.
No, we don't pay rent. What we do is we pool our financial resources. That, you know, people always said that, well, you guys just don't want to pay rent, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is that if we have to fix a roof and you have to put in some joists, these are 23-foot long, big, heavy beams, and if we have to put those in, nobody's giving us any money for this. We have to buy them. So basically, the monies that are used in the squats are to renovate the buildings and to renovate our houses, to create community spaces, community kitchens, to create areas that are public in terms of cafes and things like that, to organize in the context of freedom, not to give our money away to some landlords under the guise that they quote-unquote own the building when it was built by, you know, some Italian, Yiddish, Irish people in this neighborhood 50, 60, 70 years ago and has been bought and paid for 15,000 times over already. The whole speculation is just it's a fraud. It's a moral obscenity to have people paying out all this money to these people so that they can just sort of participate in greed, which is not healthy. It's not good for them. It's not beneficial to anyone. And so it's like if people begin to get a hold of this and understand that it's a model for people in all kinds of places, all in different parts of the world, and it's happening all over the world, and that, you know, it's a way for to empower communities. So I'm always suggesting to people that work in the housing area and so forth to begin to look seriously at this whole idea of squatting and direct action approaches to some of these areas and other creative means of utilizing rent strikes and other kinds of approaches to get housing. It's clear the federal government and the powers that be have no interest in creating affordable housing for people. They're only interested in big profits and gentrification and, you know, the kind of yuppie thing.
Yes, yeah, so the problem is very severe here in California. The housing is so extremely expensive that it's basically has the population terrorized, in my view.
Yeah, in other parts of the country or in other parts of the world where you don't have abandoned structures, per se. I'm getting very sort of particular about it now, but if you're dealing in a situation where there's just fields and so forth, like in Lima or in Mexico City or in different parts of the world where squatting is done, well, they have a different approach because obviously they're not dealing with abandoned buildings. They're dealing with whole stretches of land where they go in, and in the course of a week or two, they create whole communities. So, you know, it's a level of organization that they've taken on, and they're implementing it and creating housing for themselves. Where there's a will, there's a way. People just have to get over the fear, the kind of ideological fixation on private property, and, oh, this is somehow not right, and this kind of thing, and begin to feel what it's like to be free, feel what it's like to live outside of that speculation, of that extortion racket that people assume is it exists, therefore it's right. Well, it's not. People can begin to feel that and feel their power in organizing for these kind of direct action takeovers and creating housing for themselves and collectively defending it.
Well, that's so inspiring. Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, thank you, Bonnie.
I've been speaking with author and housing activist Frank Morales. Frank Morales can be reached by email at frm@panix.com. That's frm@panix.com. Or by writing to Post Office Box 1793, New York, New York, 10009. He would be happy to provide you with a collection of his articles for a minimal fee to cover postage. Guns and Butter is edited and produced by Yaro Mako and me, Bonnie Faulkner. To leave comments or order copies of the show, call 510-848-6767, extension 628. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.net. or visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.net. Demonstrate tomorrow, Thursday, November 6th at noon, to defend Amr Gibran, Palestinian activist threatened with deportation. Speakers at the rally include Alan Benjamin, OPEIU Local 3, Ralph Schoenman, author of The Hidden History of Zion.
And that was a couple months ago, as you can hear, from Guns and Butter, played on or via the good offices of KPFA.org. In case you want to hear the whole show, in case you missed some of it, in case you want to go back and hear some of it again, I found it very interesting when I first heard it, and that's why I've replayed it again. Actually, didn't play the whole thing the first time, but now we did. You can just go on the web, and you can pick it up, KPFA.org, and then go to the past KPFA shows, and then go to Guns and Butter, and you'll find it. You're tuned to Free Radio, 96.3 FM and 101.1 FM, and www.freakradio.org in Santa Cruz, California. You might be listening to us on numerous other stations as well, different places. We are rebroadcast by sister stations in numerous places, so if you are, or wherever you are, you're welcome to call in, make commentary, give your own thoughts on what you've heard. 831-427-3772 is the call-in number, 427-3772. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrobs Pierre's Broadsides, the Sunday morning show that goes from 9:30 to 1 o'clock. So we've got about an hour left in the show, a little bit more, and we're going to have a little musical break, and then we're going to turn to a brief examination of the newsmakers of 2003, or perhaps those who did some stuff that should be news but ain't. So stay with us.
How far down do you think you can fall until you hit the bottom of the wall? You may keep on falling and you end up far from the town, even in hell. Simple lesson in gravity. With clarity, you can dive into an empty and swimming pool. Plenty of foam, looking very cool. Flying through the air like an acrobat. Poor dude, you don't know where you're at, because right then you hit rock bottom. Rock bottom. It's such a long way back to the top. Rock bottom. Let me know what you can do to make it stop. Rock bottom. So far down, you don't dare to look up. Rock bottom. Get back to where you were, it's gonna feel a little tough. From rock bottom. One day you find you're out of your depth. Like a proud bruiser who looks as overslept. You realize you've been skydiving all your life. Something you like gets cut by a knife. Deciding day on the stock exchange. Everyone looking to make a little change. Up in your high rise off the penthouse. When you hope to make it to a private henhouse. You're up on the skyline and start to break. All the support was nothing but a fake. It's time to give way. It's time to realize. It's turned out your day when you hit rock bottom. It's such a long way back to the top. Rock bottom. You're looking on what you could do to make it stop. Rock bottom. So far down, you don't dare to look up.
Sounds like rock bottom, and perhaps not the best quality recording, from Surreal, again, Man of the Streets, and the Man with the Piano. So I promised you we're going to be moving into the 2003 retrospective. Who should be in the news but isn't? Who is in the news, and probably we've heard too much about them already. And I've got, of course, the newspaper of disrepute or record, the Sunday Santa Cruz Sentinel, with me. What I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to postpone this for a few minutes because, actually, I have one of the newsmakers who came into the studio briefly with his dog, BW. The dog didn't come into the studio. After all, we have a dog-free studio, but well, there's some dogs, I've got to admit, to get out over the air anyway. But he is a man who regular listeners may know has been dragged through the courts, through the jail, and really be given quite a nasty ride by City Manager for Life Dick Wilson and his cohorts in the District Attorney's Office and the City Attorney's Office and the Police Department. His major crime has been that he lives in his vehicle and what everybody does when their rights are taken away, some people resist with force. Some might say adequate force, and that's what he does. Now, he's recently served time in jail for, he was acquitted of the charge of battery on an officer, Officer Seeley, who was one of the officers who came to give him a dog on the beach ticket, or actually he was being given a dog on the beach ticket, selectively harassed for that particular incident by one of the rangers at Its Beach when they found an old warrant that apparently was a bad warrant, and he wanted to go to the court to do the take me to a magistrate thing, which for those of you who don't know, you have a right to be taken to a magistrate prior to being booked in jail if you are actually fortunate enough to be seized by the police during the court's business hours. Actually, I think it's any time. They should have a court clerk available at the court, but they don't. And Santa Cruz, because of the work of Richard Quigley and Kate Wells, has begun to implement, albeit somewhat shakily and somewhat unevenly, the right of a person to be taken to a magistrate first if they so choose, since it's a part of state law and they really have no alternative once the issue is raised. Nonetheless, Yon wanted to go to the magistrate under his own power, not in handcuffs, and they insisted he be handcuffed, and so he was he resisted slightly, and they charged him with resisting arrest, and they charged him with battery on a police officer because they say his foot struck Officer Eric Seeley. That charge was eventually he was acquitted by the jury of that, but he was found guilty of resisting arrest. Jan has been on the air and done some interesting role-playing analysis for us on how to deal with an arrest, because he's got and how to deal with a trial, because I think he's had some interesting and successful encounters, particularly with respect to vehicles. He's done a lot of research in how to fight them if they try to take your vehicle. And for a homeless person whose vehicle may be their home, their only home, that is a very important issue, and one which HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, has not done a lot on in terms of legal specifics. And so we're really hoping that Jan will continue to work with us on this and work out he's been doing a flyer on that issue. And indeed, I believe the court has suggested as part of his community service he can do that. Maybe he will be continuing that work with us. He is coming back to the studio, I hope, soon, and he can talk a little bit about his sense of Newsmakers of the Year. And I invite anybody who's out there to call in and talk about who they think should be considered a newsmaker or someone worthy of attention this year, worthy of some kind of recognition. I guess newsmaker, to some extent, applies to the publicity you actually got in the newspapers, and that is... considering the quality of the newspapers that we are forced to contend with, not such a meaningful criterion. But actually, Jan Golder has just returned to the studio, and I'm not sure where BW is. He's probably guarding the vehicle or something.
Guarding the station.
Guarding the station. Ah, you see, now we have a watchdog here, so don't mess with Free Radio Santa Cruz. BW will get you, and that's not GW, that's BW. Let's get that clear. Well, so what I've got here, I'm going to show you the front page, Young. I guess we can sort of start to roll into this, is the newsmakers of 2003. And then, of course, we're trying to compile a list of the real newsmakers. And I put you in that list myself because of your struggles to, well, initially simply to get questions answered about sports fields and the Pogonip, and then to find out why they were taking your vehicle and why you didn't get a hearing. And then you were reduced in this unusual situation to the position of being allowed only 5 questions per month. You weren't allowed to directly address any questions to any city employees, or even, I guess, to do that by phone. You had to do it in writing, and they were supposed to respond in writing. And, of course, apparently that hasn't been terribly satisfactory. It's an absurd system. I mean, you know, if you've got a question about a city procedure, regardless of whether you're a serial killer or whatever you are, you should have the right to ask that question and get, you know, whatever answer, you know, any citizen would be entitled to get, any member of the public, any member of the community. And that, of course, has not been afforded you as, I think, punishment for your persistence in trying to get Dick Wilson and the staff that covers him and all, and the city council and the city departments and the city police department to respond. Welcome, Yon.
Good morning, Robert.
Yeah, so, and you've gone through all kinds of trials, not just losing your property, not just losing your vehicle, not just losing, you know, I don't know how many hundreds of hours, thousands of hours of time. You've been jailed. You've been dragged through the court. How are you doing there, big fella?
Well, I'm having a tough time with it, with just dealing with it, with the fact that I really haven't gotten anywhere dealing with the city. I think the most discouraging thing is that there's laws that protect us supposedly against unlawful seizures and give us hearings, and the city essentially, in my case, blatantly ignored those laws and refused to give me hearings. And previous to that, when I was seeking information about the Greenbelt, I was going on the understanding that we have the California Public Records Act, and that the business of government is a citizen has every right to ask questions about government, and especially to get information that we know is on file with the government. And I found it just frustrating, mind-boggling that the city staff could just blatantly refuse to give out the information that was requested.
I've actually gone through, mentioned this bizarre stipulation you agreed to with Judge Attic, which I guess you're allowed to ask 5 questions a month, and I guess you've recently asked Council Member Vice Mayor Mike Riot Act Rotkin, as I call him, the surname, I should say, the nickname Riot Act stems from Mike's tendency to leap in and try to punish, penalize, and suppress critics at city council, as well as in the past, critics who've had signs which denounced him out in front of city hall at protests against the sleeping ban, particularly in 1996. He was notorious for this when he was mayor in that year. But you actually went to Mike and asked for him some assistance, and then how's that going?
Well, you know, one thing about, I think Mike is pretty accessible. He does invite people to call him and talk with him, and he met with me. He had promised me at city council to get some answers about these Greenbelt issues. And my,
when did he make that promise?
Well, that was months ago, but I just simply hadn't followed up on it completely. You know, the issue with me about the Greenbelt is that there's a tremendous amount of money being spent on a Greenbelt that the public is not really aware of. My rough guess from the investigations that I did is that it's at least $500,000 a year. And the city council is, of course, claiming that they're pretty much broke and in the red.
You know,
and yet they're not up front. They simply don't want this information released, to the best of my knowledge. They just wouldn't.
What kinds of questions were you asking? What are the last 5 questions you asked various city departments that have not been answered? And when did you ask them?
Well, I asked these questions. Actually, I asked them about some of them about 2 or 3 times to the to Parks and Recreation director, Danette Shoemaker. She's the interim director. They're looking for a new director at this point. And one of the main questions I asked was I wanted a list of all the studies and reports, extensive reports, studies that have gone into queries about the Greenbelt.
You know, without going into the merits of the Greenbelt issue, which to me is another issue which, frankly, I'm not terribly interested in as far as low-income people goes, although I understand it could be of importance in some respects. I'm more interested in the process by which you've been cut off from a normal community participation on these issues and punished for raising issues in a persistent way the city council and the city manager's office particularly doesn't like, and kind of where that stands now. That's my, maybe you can view it from that perspective for us.
Yeah, I'm puzzled too, because essentially what we agreed to after all this tremendous conflict that was mostly based on me trying to find out about my vehicles, and unbeknownst to me that the police had reported one of my vehicles with a wrong license number, making it impossible for me to recover it, that the we came to a stipulation under Judge Attic that the city was to answer 5 of my questions a month, and this was, I understand that's a limitation nobody else has, but it's they weren't answering any of my questions previous, and I thought it would be an improvement.
Had they answered any of your questions in a meaningful way since back in February or something?
Only a few, maybe three of 20 questions have been answered, and this was supposed to have been reviewed by Judge Attic in August. I didn't drag it back into court. I could if I had the time and energy to do it, and the city essentially is in a position where they've violated the court order. They made the promise, they said they'd answer the questions, and they just ignored it. So what it gets down to me is the integrity of city officials like the city attorney and the city manager.
Now, this has become an issue more recently in the email when activist Sherry Connable brought up the question of police surveillance of political protests. For those who are interested, you can get a kind of a capsule summary of Sherry Connable's position by going to the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, www.indymedia.org. If you go there, you'll find this discussion about how Sherry observed back in these huge protests, particularly the big one on February 15th in Santa Cruz, which had thousands of people marching and going up to the Mission Plaza Park, police officers in plain clothes surveilling the protest. There were police officers in uniform around, but there was also political surveillance going on, which Sherry only recently kind of brought up. And she's wondering how to deal with this. And Thomas Levitt, former city council candidate, also a Huff member to his credit, suggested, as did I, that the Public Records Act be used to get the all instances of the police department's political intelligence files, all instances of surveillance in the last year. What do you think of that idea?
Well, some of the police records are protected. Actually, quite a few of police records are protected if it's part of an ongoing investigation, and they feel that disclosing the information will derail the investigation, put that in peril. And of course, this is a really gray one that can be argued a lot of different ways, but police don't like to let the public know when they're doing an investigation, and yet when they're doing something broad and spending a great deal of time and effort to link all kinds of people with activities that are on the edge of they may be legal or they may evolve into something illegal, then it becomes, I think, very controversial. It's something that is probably the ideal place to look at something like that would be the grand jury, where the grand jury can look at both sides of the issue. And
have you been successful in either complaints to the police department, or I should say complaints, or Public Records Act requests, either the police department or the grand jury? I know I I've made some public records acts requests to the police department, which generally come up empty, although when I seek information about my own cases, I've got a case about, you know, amplified music on the sidewalk, which I actually got a tape. I got an audio tape. I got a massive police report, and all came back very quickly, and I was surprised, probably because I happened to run into Deputy City Attorney George Kovacevic in line at the one of the counters at the basement of the county building. But how have you been in terms of success in either going to the grand jury or the police department and getting records?
Well, I've had some success at the police department. I haven't really used the grand jury yet. I think the frustrating thing for me is I had requested two investigations through the Citizens Police Review Board more than a year ago when my vehicles were impounded. And the circumstances, which I won't go into at this time, were, I think, highly irregular. I was not granted any hearings, and even though I knew I was entitled to them and demanded them, and the circumstances under which the vehicles were actually taken were pretty fuzzy. One of them was taken basically at force of arms from me in downtown Santa Cruz, where the police officer threatened to shoot my dog in front of a crowd of onlookers. And this is for unproven parking tickets. So when I asked for these investigations...
Is the dog responsible for your parking ticket situation? I mean, is that...
No.
Can we really hold that...
No.
Okay.
No, the police officer was worried that the dog was going to attack him, and I was insisting on my rights that my vehicle was being unlawfully seized. They hadn't really encountered someone refusing to give up their vehicle. In any case, I asked for an investigation, and it never happened. And I tried for a long time to find out what happened with the investigation, and eventually, more than 6 months later, went to Bob Aronson, the independent police auditor, and he couldn't find anything out for 4 months additionally. So I finally started calling the police department myself, and when I got a hold of Internal Affairs, Sergeant Rick Martinez, who is in that office now and was not previous at the time the investigation was requested, essentially gave me the information that Police Chief Belcher, when he had received my requests, had changed them from an investigation, both requests for a formal investigation, to an inquiry, which is essentially a very informal process of asking a few questions. And they essentially said they were done with the investigation in a matter of days and less time than it normally takes for them to even get a formal investigation request. So, and then I asked Martinez, how could he do that? And Martinez said, well, it's Belcher's department and he can do anything he wants.
Now, of course, Chief Scarry's department.
Yeah, well, yeah. And there was an interesting article in the paper about how open, I saved the article about how open the department is supposed to be. It's supposed to be more open and all that. But I had a meeting with Emily Riley about this. And Emily Riley, at least she said to me, I don't know if she really said she was in shock, that she said, they can't do that. They can't just drop an investigation request and make it into an inquiry and essentially whitewash the thing.
This is the same Emily Riley, former mayor, now city council member, who voted to destroy the Citizens Police Review Board and put everything in the hands of out-of-town attorney Aronson, Bob Aronson.
Yeah, and Bob Aronson was the attorney for the Citizens Police Review Board.
Right,
so
he was.
The point is...
Now he gets paid $42,000 a year to shuffle a few papers around, apparently not to pursue the investigations.
Well, Aronson doesn't. He's got very little effective power. He can't really disclose anything, find anything out, and he can find out for himself. He can review it, and all he can do is say, "Well, they did a good job, or they didn't do a good job." In fact, he can't even really put judgment on it. He can just say, "Well, they did the job, or they didn't do the job." In my case, he essentially said they didn't do it. They have no file on the investigation. They didn't do it. And that's all the information he can release.
You know, we're actually, in a way, we're straying a little far afield because we were talking about great people of the year or this says newsmakers of the year, great people in some respects, of which I believe you are one. But I like this straying away, and since we're not getting a massive phone-in about it, I've got no problem with it. I want to get back to this, the issue, though, of... You know, you suggest a grand jury complaint. I don't know that anything has ever come out of a grand jury complaint in this county. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some callers can give me some leeway. I'm not saying people shouldn't. I think that, you know, all kinds of avenues are good, provided, you know, you portion your time and don't get lost in this stuff and don't put any false hopes into it. But I know that Richard Quigley, who's a former KSCO talk show host, or you might say a talk show host on leave from KSCO after pressure, he alleges, from the sheriff, Mark Tracy, has filed, I guess he's filed complaints with the IA, Internal Affairs Division of the Sheriffs. He's filed complaints with the grand jury, I suspect. I'm not entirely sure about that. And he is also, most importantly, and finally, which prompted a front page Sentinel story a week and a half ago, gone to federal court on the issue. What about going to federal court?
Well, if I had the resources, that's where I'd be going. I essentially feel that the city denied me due process. Several attorneys have looked it over and said they feel the same way. Federal lawsuit is a pretty involved thing, and the resources that the city has to throw at you are considerable. Now, I beat them at their injunction game, and I felt pretty good about that.
That was the famous injunction that, I should say, letter of trespass, which Dick Wilson used in lieu of an injunction order from the courts that required you to stay away, not just from the city manager's office, not just from the city council offices, but from every single city office and from every city officer, including the public library.
And all city property, too, yeah. He tried to enforce that on me, and here's the crux of my fears about this, and it's the fact that I was trying very hard to find out about my vehicles, okay, and I was asking lots of questions, and I was banging on the doors, not literally but literally, I was down at the police station trying to get some answers. Now, the police had made a mistake, which was unknown to me and essentially unknown to them, that they had put the wrong license number down on my this trailer that got towed.
But that still kept your trailer in their hands, and you've lost it, right?
Well, yeah, the trailer's long gone. But the point is, I was trying to get a hearing. And
which is guaranteed you by what state law?
I can't name the law right now, but it's part of the whole section on towing and impounding. And essentially, anyone who has an interest in a vehicle is entitled to a hearing. I mean, you don't have to be the owner of the vehicle. And they were questioning my connection with the ownership. But the crux of it is, I had made dozens of contacts with the police department. I had been rebuffed at every single one. And Dick Wilson knew about these efforts because I had given a letter previous. Through Ed Porter. Ed Porter had met in person with Dick Wilson.
He's a council member, Ed Porter.
Yeah, Ed Porter's a councilman. He met in person with Dick Wilson and handed him this 5-page letter that took me almost 2 weeks to write, 2 weeks in a law library to write. And so Dick Wilson was very much aware of my efforts to retrieve my vehicle. And yet, when after my arrest at City Hall, where they did their final attempt to crack down and keep me away from city offices, and then they tried to get an injunction against me in while I was in jail waiting on charges that eventually everything was dropped, Dick Wilson, during that injunction hearing, I got a chance to actually cross-examine him, and I asked him the question. I said, what did you know about the information I was trying to obtain? And he said, all I knew about was about the Greenbelt and Parks and Recreation issues. And the city had tried very hard to quashed almost all of my subpoenas about witnesses that knew otherwise, and yet I was still bringing the issue up. And so Dick Wilson is sitting there telling the judge that he knew nothing about my efforts when he had met personally 5 days previous to issuing this letter of his he'd met with Ed Porter and had a 5-page letter about my vehicles and where I'd asked him numerous legal questions.
Did you confirm with Ed that he actually talked about that issue, or did he discuss the weather?
No, absolutely. Ed made it very clear that he had met with him either day or the next day after he'd gotten my letter, which was on the 13th, and then on the 18th, while I was down there in the city council at the city clerk's office trying to get some research requests, trying to get some information, just filling out written request forms and going about it politely, Dick Wilson hands me this letter.
Has Ed or anybody else been of use in the last year in furthering your struggle to get information? Let's not even talk about justice. I mean, that's in a that's a visionary concept these days. I know that, you know, you get a lot of lip service from people like Rotkin and others. Rotkin is, I guess, may have been approached, hopefully has been approached by Thomas Levitt. I approached him asking for information about which police officer positions have been eliminated. As you know, we have the budget crisis, and a lot of us are concerned that the police department is suffering far less, getting much smaller reductions in its budget than the social services and other departments are getting. And I'm finding that, you know, I'm not getting meaningful response from these folks. It's lip service. Are you getting anything of substance coming out of from any of these people?
I think I could define it as lip service because no tangible results have come back from any of I've had, I think, 5 different meetings with different city council people on kind of various aspects of my issues, and nothing solid has ever come through. The only results I've really obtained, Robert, was kind of through discovery process in court, and a little bit through freedom of through California Public Records Act.
I think the discovery process in court is, of course, key. If you have a court case, it's often a way, ironically, you're being charged with a bunch of nonsense, but you get an opportunity to demand all their records, and that can be useful, I think, in letting the community know what's going on, as well as planning. I mean, you can plan your own defense to charges, but more important, you get information that would otherwise be very difficult to dislodge. You'd have to do a formal lawsuit, a civil lawsuit. You'd have to have friends inside the affected agencies who are willing to, you know, share that information with you. You have to be on good terms with the higher-ups, or they'd have to be actually lawfully responding, as you pointed out, to Public Records Act requests, which I don't see a lot of response to. I mean, I have gotten some interesting documents from the city manager's office around, for example, the downtown ordinances and the forbidden fence. Actually, I didn't go after that. Was in front of New Leaf Market when they put up a forbidden fence. But I'm talking more about the Pacific Trading Company's machinations with the police department and the redevelopment agency.
Yeah, the emails you got in that I thought were pretty revealing.
Interesting
about
emails about
of city administration.
Showing the favoritism toward merchants. We got an incoming call here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, I can tell because I can barely hear you.
Oh, well, good. We can hear you just fine, Richard Quigley, you scoundrel, dragging our poor Sheriff Mark Tracy through the mud.
Who?
That's the sheriff of our county, Mr. Goes to Federal Court to try to harass deputies who are just trying to get a little a better clientele at the Aptos Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, I mean, that's a slight distortion, but I'll accept that. So,
you're one of our newsmakers of the year, who doesn't seem to be featured in today's Sentinel.
I wasn't featured as a newsmaker of the year.
No, they had Dick Wilson. He was featured.
Well, Dick Wilson has a very important job.
Yeah, they had Lou Harrison, Bo Hart, Harvey Nicholson, John Hurd, De La Paz, De La Cruz, the Murrays, Amy Brown, and I guess the troops in Iraq got featured.
Yeah.
How nice to feature them as they get shot down like tin pins. And then, of course, the De Anza residents, the people that the city council sold out. But you're not featured. Now,
well, that's okay. I can see where I didn't rise to those levels. I mean, these are very important people that have undoubtedly made substantial contributions one way or the other.
Your humility sickens me, Richard, I've got to say.
It sickens me as well.
Yeah.
What can I do?
Well, I know that you've got a website up about... I mentioned previously in the show that you have filed a federal lawsuit against Sheriff Mark Tracy for a campaign of harassment stretching back to 1994 against you, including political files, sending a representative to the KSCO management where you were working to get you off the air, beating up or harassing of your girlfriend,
By the way, you can now hear that on the web.
You can actually hear the beating up?
Yeah, I have the recording. It's a real audio format, but if you have real audio, and if you don't have it, you can certainly get it. They're not charging for that yet.
In the studio with me is Jon Golder. Let's get your website, and we'll mention it a couple times on the air so people can listen to this corrective behavior, correcting the behavior of our citizens that the police sometimes do in order to make sure that we're all, you know, in order.
Well, what I did was that I linked the story from the KSCO page where I have all my radio shows, and you can get to that by going to usff.com. That's the acronym for United States Freedom Fighter, USFF. I don't know why people have so much trouble getting those letters straight, but they do.
USFF. Mm-hmm.
USFF.com. And then a little, one of little slashes that leans to the right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then QUIG.
QUIG.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one of them little slashes, and then uppercase, as the signal would indicate, KSCO.
Uh-huh.
And that'll take you to my to the page where I have all those radio shows. And then down at the bottom, I have a story about how it came to be that I did my last show on December 11th, how it came to pass.
That's a transcript or a written analysis?
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, I just wrote a little story from my perspective about what took place there. And then as you scroll down through that story, there's another link that you can click to that will take you to the story on the beating of my girlfriend, and I sort of picked that up at the very beginning of the bullshit down there in the shopping center.
The Aptos Rancho del Mar, yeah.
How through my involvement in that shopping center, I ended up having Laurie just beat the shit, and then there's a link from there that goes to the transcript so that you can read it as you hear it, and a link from there to the real audio file.
So you actually have, for anyone who wants that, you all of your radio shows for the last year on KSCO are not only archived on this or a nearby website there, but they are also briefly described in succinct phrases, so you can go directly to different radio shows and actually hear them if you want.
Yeah, I don't know how close the descriptions are, but it's just a general idea, because I, you know, it's like anybody will in the course of an hour, you know, you float around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed as I read through there's some things that I do remember talking about that I didn't highlight in those summaries, but I never thought to put the summaries up until somebody just persistently stayed on me about it.
Well, your fans have their demands. What can one say?
Yeah, you certainly did. It did, Robert, but I finally got around to it.
Excellent. Yeah, I want to thank you for that, and plus posting the, I guess I've been ragging you for a year that KSCO has not allowed you to play I guess you may have played it for me at one time. I don't know if you did or not. But this incident, which happened 3 or 4 years ago, where Laurie was...
Actually, I think it was 97.
Wow, six years ago now, I guess.
But it was 97, 98, but it's very ugly. And you know, I would warn anybody that is especially women, not that women are particularly more sensitive than men, but especially women, since it has to do with the you know, abusive handling of a female by male officers, and it's rather graphic for an audio, and it might tend to upset the faint of heart. So, you know, that was one of the reasons that I didn't make a bigger stir when they thought it would be best not played at KSCO, because there's some things that are just a little hard to sleep with after you hear them. You know,
isn't it a little harder to sleep, though, knowing that we have to deal with unresolved abuses by deputies who are engaging in such conduct?
Well, we tried very hard to get that in front of as many people as possible when it happened, and to get the behavior corrected. But since it was obviously, if not thought of, certainly condoned by Mark Tracy, it wasn't something we were able to really get any sort of shock effect, you know, get people to react against it. The guy that actually physically was in charge of this whole assault on this young woman ended up ended up retiring. He's living out in the middle of the San Joaquin Valley right now, drawing a nice little pension check.
That's a Sergeant Deverell we're talking about?
No, Deverell's hanging around town drawing a fat little pension check, but he too should be in jail. All the people that participated in that, as far as I'm concerned, should have seen some time in jail and most certainly shouldn't be living on retirement right now. But Mark has his priorities.
Tracy, our sheriff.
Yeah, Mark Tracy, you're a sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
You're a sheriff.
Well, now, I know that you've been sort of removed from the air. You put on leave of absence. Any further developments?
Well, no. It would seem to me that knowing that he's been sued for interfering with that access to my show, you know, having my show and all, that at least the very least I would have thought would have happened from their office by now would have been to send that same deputy back in there, explain it, say, look, you know, you probably misunderstood what we were saying, and we didn't really mean to put enough pressure on you for him to be off the air, and we really apologize. There won't be any problem if he goes back on the air. And it seems to me like they'd be doing everything they can to mitigate, what they call in legal terms, mitigate damages. There would be some effort, you know, to encourage KSCO to put me back on the air, since they were the ones that encouraged my removal. But these people, you know, mindless people do mindless things, and so there's not going to be, it's apparently not going to be much intelligence applied to this from that side. So I think you can just pretty much consider I'm done with radio this county.
Well, of course, you are invited to come on free radio during my show and do your 40-minute kick-ass discussion of various issues, ranging from, well, I mean, occasionally you talked about the problems in the police department and suggestions you had for improving police policies and specific concerns about particular abuses.
I like to think that I balanced my show with a lot of different concerns. You know, I talked about bad cops a lot because that was one of the things that very few people will discuss. They just won't bring it up, and it may be that they didn't have the combination of experience and availability of the airtime to do it. So I saw that as a very important part of my show. But I also talked about the housing problems in Santa Cruz and the social cleansing, you know, liberal fascism crap that goes on, and the administration of the county by the board. I mean, I talked about a lot of different things because there's a lot that goes on in this county that deserves the light of day on the one hand and recognition sometimes on the other.
Not
everything I talked about was wicked, terrible, and evil.
Indeed. Any feedback from your former listeners about, or from your listeners about what, you know, that they'd like to see you, or any indication from KSCO, from any of, you know, that there's been any kind of outpouring of support for you, or has there been a deafening silence, or what's been happening?
No, KSCO's always been fairly tight-lipped about all the comments that they get, unless it was really outrageous, you know, that something came through that was particularly obnoxious. They say, well, we got this message or we got this letter, what do you think of that? And I always responded to that, but I haven't heard anything from them about whatever public reaction there may have been at the station.
Any other commentators discuss your situation on the air?
No. I said, well, man, you talk about a poison subject on that radio station. That's not to be brought up, I'm certain.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, man, this is, you know.
You're not talking censorship on KSCO.
No, not at all. It has to do with the sensitivity of the subject. I think that they just seem not get into it for a myriad of reasons, not the least of which is that there's ongoing litigation, and it's from their point of view.
Wait a minute, there's no litigation against KSCO. I'm sure they comment on lots of ongoing litigation.
Well, from their point of view, it was my First Amendment rights that were attacked, and it was me that filed suit, and so they really don't have any part in that from their perspective, and I don't know that I necessarily disagree with them. You know, that's fine.
They're a news station. They're a news talk, 1080.
Well,
they don't regard that as news. I mean,
they did break the story when I filed the lawsuit. They did, in fact, break the story, and it was a couple, 3 days in advance of when something came out in the Sentinel. I guess it was a couple days before the article came in the Sentinel.
I know, but you're suggesting that perhaps they are, should we say, muzzling or damping down the subject if and when it comes up on the air.
Well, I think that's probably pretty intelligent when you have a sheriff that is threatening to cut off your access to news sources out of the county sheriff's office to keep yourself out of the line of fire. When you have a news talk radio station, and maintain a relationship that allows you access to your life's blood.
Yeah,
I don't see that as a terrible thing.
I've heard this justification of the Zwirling and the KSCO agenda before, their policies before, and I'm no more impressed with it now than I was when you first discussed it. I think you're being overly generous to them. I believe they have responsibility to the community at all. It's to let the community know when political surveillance, when political censorship is happening, when they collude with it, they collude with it. And as far as I'm concerned, they're colluding with it. They can get plenty of information from the police, from various sources around the police department, if they need to. And, you know, the fact that they're not first with how many arrests happen in a particular week is not going to break them or cause them to lose any advertisers.
Well,
what I
find interesting while this discussion is taking place, what I found interesting is that of all the news sources in this county, the number of people that have covered this particular series of events, you know, this whole thing with the sheriff attempting to and successfully apparently attempting to shut down commentary from a radio station, has gone virtually unnoticed except by the Sentinel. I thought the Sentinel did a very, especially in light of the fact that they seem to be the only media to cover it, a pretty brave thing.
Now, just a moment. The Street Shit Sheet did a special issue.
Excuse me. Your present company excluded. Yeah. I wasn't including you. You always handle the hot things, but what I'm talking about is that the TV, there's been nothing on any of the TV networks, and they surely know about it. The Mercury News didn't pick up on this. I didn't see anything in the Chronicle, and I don't know of any other sheriff in the state of California that has been so sued. Now, I know that there's a sheriff in, I want to say Southern California, but it occurs to me it could have been the Southern United States, but there was a sheriff somewhere that a chaplain had been given access to the jail in his district and had some comments to make about the jail and was subsequently not allowed to go in the jail and do his chaplain work because he revealed some of the mis and malfeasance on the part of the sheriff. But other than that, I've not heard anybody else ever go to these lengths to censor criticism, and since I see it as a huge First Amendment, I mean, it goes right at the heart of the First Amendment, huge violation, then you have to wonder why these other media people haven't picked up on it. And of course, it occurs to me that the danger that comes with that kind of criticism is very real, and therefore I have to again say that I think that the Zwirlings are justified and very much trying to stay out of it to the extent that they can. I mean, they definitely reported the story. They didn't put any particular bias on it one way or the other, and were the first to report the story when I first filed suit.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I haven't heard. You know, the Metro, who's always ready to criticize me and write half accurate stories that seem to linger forever, haven't touched it, haven't seen anything or heard anything but good times. None of these regular commercial news media are doing anything with it. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, hats off to the Sentinel and to the KSCO for at least having the courage to bring it to their audience.
Well, you're making me ill again, but
I got the phone calls, man. I know where the people that were my listeners, you know, the portion that chose to call me,
mm-hmm.
got their information.
Mm-hmm.
And they got the information that this had happened from the radio station and from the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably had, I'll be conservative, I'm going to say 20 phone calls in a period of the 3 or 4 days following the news break at the radio station that I filed the suit.
Any, what's the next date coming up which people should be aware of if they want to stay abreast of your federal lawsuit, which I guess is going through the San Jose federal court?
Well, they have 20 days to file their response from the time they're served, and I'm anticipating that, assuming how good he is at hiding, that service on Tracy will probably take place the first part of next week.
Are you going to have a photographer there and perhaps a, you know, a special group of people clapping as this happens?
No, what we need to do is get it served. Whether or not there's a spontaneous response when it happens will all depend on where it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that the support has been surprising in its sources. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people that work inside that concrete-looking bunker down there. You know, a lot of words of encouragement have come from inside that building, and sympathy.
Hello.
And then regret for the fact that these things happened at all, and I'm really sorry they happened. I wish it hadn't reached this proportion. It's disgusting to me.
No, it's too bad. I mean, I thought you were going through a lot of interesting and valuable stuff on the air, and I again encourage you to consider coming on our rather limited, but still not entirely inconsiderable Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're talking with Richard Quigley, who has been retired or put on leave of absence, as a KSCO Noontime Thursday commentator and news broadcaster, and apparently you don't expect they're going to be recalling you anytime soon?
I've learned to expect what happens. That way I'm never surprised and never disappointed.
Hear, hear. And again, give us your website if people want to go and hear some of your past shows or catch on breaking events on this issue.
The easiest way is just usff.com/Quig and Q-U-I-G, and that way that'll get them to my main website, and then they can just click on the radio talk show host thing, and that'll lead them to the story as to what took place there.
Sounds
and
good.
I don't think I'll be adding anything more to that now that it's up.
www.usff.com/QUIG Quig.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, Richard, thank you. Anything you want to conclude with?
Yeah, tell Jan nice work. I'm telling you, man, he is a very, very gutsy freedom fighter, that gentleman.
You're talking about Jan Golder, our man of the year here in the studio?
Yeah, I hold Jan in very high regard. This is one of the guys that puts his ass where his mouth is, you know. And there, as you know, Robert, it's a lonely world when you start trying to count the number of people that do that.
Jan, anything you want to say to Richard? For you guys can do it. Some mutual admiration here, if you
don't. Yeah, we'll let him off the hook, but that's just, you know,
he's right here. He's got a word or two to say to you.
Well, thank you, Robert. Richard, you're the one who inspired me.
Oh, Lord, don't tell them that. They'll be out hunting me down for sure.
Oh, yeah, my mistake.
John, the heart that you've got doesn't come from outside, my friend. It comes from inside. That's where that's at. And I consider you one of the great freedom fighters of this county. I think you just do excellent work.
Well, thank you.
You are one dogged, determined individual, and proud to be working.